We can go ahead and call the meeting to order. This is the first meeting of the 2016 Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety. So I want to welcome you here today. I want to thank you for taking your time to come. I'm going to go ahead and introduce the Sergeant at Arms. From the Senate, we have Jim Hamilton. Thank you, Jim. Larry Hancock. Thank you. From the House, Bill Bass, Mark Cohn, and David Lithicum. Thank you. Before we begin our agenda, I'm going to call on Christy Agner. If she would come to the back, I think she has a guest with her today, and I'm going to ask her to introduce her guest.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I'm Christy Agner with the Department of Justice. I want to introduce someone who's shadowing me today. This is Sarah Hallett, and she was Speaker of the Girl State Program this summer, and I'll let her introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Sarah Hallett. I'm a senior at Carson High School in Salisbury, North Carolina, and I'm very excited to be here observing this meeting today.
Thank you, Christy. At this time, we're going to do some introductions and see if the other chairs have comments. Of course, my co-chairs are Representative Bowles, Representative Hurley, and I will yield the floor to either of them if they have something to say. The only comment that I will make, and I've said this in our standing committee meeting, you know, when people are asked to come, it's not like we have questions and, you know, we're going to pin you on some answer, or you're going to try to give us the right answer or the wrong answer. There is no right or wrong answer. We are here today and at all of these meetings to gather information. Based on that information, then the committee will decide what action needs to be taken, if any action needs to be taken. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and have, let me introduce our committee clerks, Jeb Kelly, Deborah Holder, and Carrie Geis is also one of our committee clerks. I'm going to ask our staff, our legislative staff, to introduce themselves, and I will move aside so you can see them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christine Leggett with Fiscal Research. I cover DPS administration, Highway Patrol, State Capitol Police, SBI, Emergency Management, National Guard, and the Department of Justice.
I'm John Petit with Fiscal Research, and I cover the prison budget.
I'm Lisa Fox with Fiscal Research. I cover juvenile justice, community corrections, and indigent defense services.
William Childs with Fiscal Research. I cover AOC, the Administrative Office of the Courts.
Susan Seitz with the Research Division. I cover all the criminal justice issues, motor vehicle, juvenile justice, and alcoholic beverage control.
Thank you, Steph. And I would, excuse me, we have some on the other side.
Jan Paul, Research Division, just General Criminal Justice.
Jennifer Bedford, also the Criminal Justice Division and also Military Affairs.
Emily Johnson, I'm in Bill Drafting in Draft Criminal Law.
Sean Dale, also in Bill Drafting, and I draft in Courts and Corrections.
Thank you all, and I'm sorry, we would never want to look over our legal staff, so thank you very much. Our staff works really hard, and without them, our jobs would be very difficult, if not almost impossible. So I do thank you, and I know that the other chairs and the committee members thank you. We're going to go around the room and let the committee members introduce themselves, and I'm going to start with Representative Burr.
Thank you. Justin Burr, represent the 67th District of the North Carolina House.
Leo Daughtry from Smithfield, represent the 26th District in the House.
John Faircloth from High Point, representing the 61st District.
Charles Graham, House District 47, Robeson County.
Jonathan Jordan, House District 93, Ashland, Watauga Counties.
Mike Pashali, I represent Craven, Pamlico, and Beaufort Counties.
Lee Zachary. I represent District 73, which is Yadkin, part of Wilkes, and Alexander counties.
Stan Bingham, representing Davidson County and Montgomery County. And seems like a lot of our Senate colleagues aren't present today, but we've got making up for it with all the presence of the House members. Thank you much, Madam Chairman.
Michael Lee, New Hanover County, District 9.
Andy Wells from Hickory, 42nd Senate District.
Representative Rena Turner, District 84 in the House, which is Iredell County.
Alan McNeil, House District 78, Randolph and Moore.
Darren Jackson, District 39, Eastern Wake County.
George Graham, District 12, Lenore Craven, Green Counties.
Said thank you all for being here today. And, you know, we, as issues are brought to us, we have a lot of work to accomplish over the next 4 meetings, and hopefully we will be successful at the end of our term when we go back into the when we reconvene session at the end of April. So we're going to ask a lot of everyone to make sure that we get all of our work done. I'm going to call on Susan Seitz now, who is going to go over the committee charge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to stay back here since this is going to be brief. This committee is authorized by Article 12J of Chapter 120 of the General Statutes and is created as the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety. The purpose of the committee is to examine on a continuing basis the correctional law enforcement and juvenile justice systems in North Carolina in order to make ongoing recommendations to the General Assembly on ways to improve those systems and to assist those systems in realizing their objectives of protecting the public and of punishing and rehabilitating offenders. There's a list in the statute of several specific things for them to look at. This statute, I believe, is in your packet, so I am not going to go through that list. If anyone has any questions about the details of that, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you, Susan. This year, in comparison to other years, we're going to do things a little differently. We're going to try using subcommittees to look a little bit deeper into issues that we need to address, mostly statutorily, because we have 4 statutory issues that we need to look into and see if we can make some recommendations. So in doing this, I'm hoping that it will cause the members to be more engaged, because your input into the decisions on this committee are vital. So I'm going to go ahead at this time with the committee assignments, and these would be for the subcommittees. A few weeks ago, all the members were allowed to make a request as to committees that they had greater interest in. Not that they are not interested in all of them, but they were allowed to select 2 committees. And the chairs tried to accommodate those requests as much as possible. We knew that we needed at least 5 members on each committee. We also have the chairs of those committees, and then the 4 chairs, all the co-chairs, are ex officio members of all of those committees. So I'm going to start with the IDSVs. I will be chairing this committee. The members will be Representative Turner, Representative Zachary, Senator Brown, Senator Daniel, Senator Jackson, and this would be Jeff Jackson. The future of IDS Innocence Commission will be chaired by Representative Daughtry. The members will be Representative Jackson, Representative Stevens, Representative Jordan, Senator Lee, Senator Wells. The probation parole vehicles will be chaired by Representative Hurley. The members, Representative Faircloth, Representative McNeil, Representative Zachary, Senator Bingham, Senator Jackson. Body-worn cameras will be chaired by Representatives Faircloth and McNeil. The members will be Representative Jackson, Representative Fischali, Senator Bingham, Senator Robinson. There's also a statutory joint committee between JPS and Health and Human Services. There's a House chair and a Senate chair, so the House chair will be Representative Hurley. I will be the Senate chair. The members of the Justice Reinvestment Behavioral Health Subcommittee would be Representative Burr, Representative Charles Graham, Representative George Graham, Senator Bryant, Senator Lee, and Senator Wells. So the chairs have worked today on the schedule, trying to make sure that we don't overlap and ask you to be two places at the same time. We cannot guarantee that that will not happen with the members that are on the Behavioral Health Committee, because that has to be coordinated with HHS. But we do have a schedule. You will be notified by your committee chair when the meeting is, where you should appear. And there, you know, even though we have a standard date and time, there's going to be other subcommittee meetings that you will be asked to attend. Some of those may be off-site meetings, so hopefully you will attend as many of those meetings as you possibly can. And the thing about the subcommittees, you know, we are short on time. The reports from the subcommittees will need to be back to the full JPS committee by March the 10th. So that gives us technically 2 months to get all of our investigative process complete and come back with some type of recommendation to the committee. And then the committee will decide what actions are taken from that point forward. So with that said, any questions about the assignment of subcommittees? Thank you. Thank you all again for your participation. We will now go to Christine Leggett, Department of Public Safety, Implementation of Budget Items and Reorganization. We do have another member that just came in, Representative Stevens, if you will introduce yourself, ma'am.
Representative Sarah Stevens, House District 90, Surrey, and a little bit of Wilkes, the great state of Wilkes, not a lot, but a little bit. And I've been in the House for, this is my fourth term, came in with Senator Randleman when she was a respectable House member.
Thank you, Representative Stevens. So, Christine Leggett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to JPS Oversight. As you may recall from last year, each topic we have, someone from central staff will try to frame the issue for you, give you some background information you need before we get into the meat of the presentation. So I'm going to start off today talking about legislative changes to the Department of Public Safety's Law Enforcement Division and the San Marcan Training Academy. If you look in your packet, you should have a document that looks like this. And it says 2015 legislative changes at the top. So the front page of that, I've got a summary for you of what y'all did in the budget last year. And then behind that are copies of the actual provisions that I'm going to be talking about. So the biggest change in last year's budget to the Department of Public Safety took place in Section 16A.7 of the Appropriations Act. This is on page 2 of your packet. It made several changes to various statutes to clarify the administration and organization of the department. First, subsection A makes it clear that the director of the SBI is solely responsible for all management functions of the SBI. Subsection C allows the SBI to appoint liaison personnel to lobby the legislature. Subsection D makes it clear that Isaac is under the sole control of the director of the SBI. And subsection E moved the state capitol police under the state highway patrol. Finally, subsection H makes the commander of the highway patrol a direct report to the secretary of the Department of Public Safety. Subsections B, F, I, and J were making technical and conforming changes to the statutes to eliminate references to the Division of Law Enforcement and the Commissioner of Law Enforcement. As a result of these changes, the position of Commissioner of Law Enforcement was eliminated in the committee report for a budget savings of $153,791. The second provision that I'm going to draw your attention to was Section 16A.4 of the budget. This is on page 4 of your packet. This moved the San Marcan Training Academy from under the Division of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice to the office of the secretary within the department and gave the secretary direct oversight of the director of the academy. The section also directs that the budget for the academy be kept separate from the budgets of other divisions. And finally, section 16A.3 of your budget is a boilerplate provision that's been included every year for the past 4 or 5 years. It allows the secretary to reclassify or eliminate existing positions within the Division of Administration and requires those position changes to be reported to JPS Appropriations Committee chairs within 30 days. Also included in your packet is a memo, an internal memo from the Department of Public Safety from the secretary on October 14, 2015, that outlined certain changes the Secretary of Public Safety made to the administration organization of the department. Madam Chair, that's all I have this morning. Anyone has any questions?
Are there questions for Christine Leggett? No questions? Then I think on the agenda we have Secretary Frank Perry to talk about or be open to question from the committee as to the report that's just been given by Christine Leggett. And we have an appropriate chair, I hope.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, good to see all of you. Thank you for your time this afternoon. Appreciate the members being here, and I just want to compliment you for the budget you did provide the Department of Public Safety. And I'll just mention those items briefly, but going back to 2011, this body ordered the consolidation of juvenile justice, the Department of Corrections, and the Department of Crime Control and Public Safety into one organization. And in 2013, when I came on board, my job was to see that we get beyond the beginning of the beginning. And that consolidation has only just begun. So my job, for the most part, has been to try to fully implement that consolidation. I would say to you, we're about 85% there with respect to human resources, budgeting, auditing, and that sort of thing. There are items that are yet to be fully consolidated, and it's my view that consolidation is not always absolute. There are going to be associations as opposed to complete consolidations, but we are following your guidelines. Certainly, our overall mission statement has to do with prevention, protection, and preparation. And we had begun to implement the more detailed mission of preventive intelligence-based law enforcement. And I'm open to questions about the particulars of that. I will not go into that now if you're not interested as members or if the chair is not interested in that in particular. But that's important today, not just to show up to a crime scene, but to prevent it from happening in the first place. And that has been our mission since I came on board, and we've tried to get that mission up and running and brought to full fruition. But this past budget, I had asked the governor that he consider three things. One, giving correctional officers a raise. They had not seen one in 30 years. This body provided that. I asked that troopers be provided an increase that they had not seen in some number of years. This body provided that. And we needed the best and the brightest in the healthcare profession, as well as in the psychiatry and psychological profession, to address mental health issues in our 56 correctional facilities. This body provided that. The only other item that I had requested, and I did not submit it to this group, Madam Chair, was a mechanism to further consolidate law enforcement, correctional, and juvenile justice intelligence into a case management system known as MEMEX. We have begun to complete that, and we are looking at that with asset forfeiture money, so we did not ask that of this body. I am open to questions. I thank you for what you have done. Thank you.
Do committee members have questions at this time?
Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. There's a couple, few questions I'd like to ask. First, Secretary Perry, I have heard, I don't know if other members have or not, but a concern from maybe about, sorry, about a state police. And, you know, I've never heard you mention or talk about this, but would you address that? Because I know local law enforcement do have a concern about that.
Thank you, Senator. It's good to see you, and thank you for being here. Senator, I have never advocated for a state police. I'm not sure what that gains. In fact, I had a good conversation with the executive director of the Sheriff's Association outside just before this meeting. He and I go back a few years. He knows that I do not advocate that. And there are many reasons. I will not get into those unless you ask, sir. But the main reason is, what is there to gain? Sheriffs do their job in a remarkable fashion every day, every night. Chiefs of police do that as well. The state has a function to assist them the best we can, and then we have our own original jurisdictions. But I nor the governor have never advocated that in private or in public. In fact, I think it would be counterproductive.
Madam Chairman, may I? Thank you, Madam Chairman. I know with the many different layers of law enforcement, local, state, and federal, how does that, in your opinion, the responsibility at DPS, and would you want to comment on that?
You mean bridging all together?
Correct, yes.
Senator, we are at the center of the FBI, ATF, Homeland Security, DEA. We have troopers and probationer officers, PPOs, on many federal task forces, I think 8 total. That is a force multiplier. It does not take away from the mission of probation and parole officers, PPOs. It does not take away from the much-needed work of correctional officers. It does not take away from the work of the highway patrol. What it does, it allows us to understand what they understand, and then they understand what we understand. We collaborate. We join forces to implement in a different way this predictive intelligence-based model of law enforcement. So we have them on this side. The bridge is DPS with the task forces on this side, and then our local and other state partners on the other side. And we all come together, and we did so in DPS with a law enforcement division. That brought everybody together to prevent everything from gang violence to traditional crime to drug trafficking to terrorism.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't want to dominate this. I know a lot of the House members and others have questions too, but you mentioned gangs, and I've heard my local sheriff and others talk about this problem with gangs. Do you see that as a issue that has concern as far as you as director or secretary?
Yes, sir. Gangs are in North Carolina. I've talked with sheriffs that believe that 90% of their violent crime in their respective counties is because of gangs. DPS operates houses and maintains GangNet, a database for gangs. There are 1,018 gangs recognized in North Carolina, not gang members, gangs. And currently, there are 314 active gangs in North Carolina. They're in our correctional facilities where they conceive and order crime to be orchestrated outside of prisons. It happened last year in the kidnapping matter out of Wake Forest. And where DPS was the liaison from the FBI to the Wake Forest Police, The father of that assistant DA was rescued in Georgia one day before he would have died. Gangs are a major problem, and we are doing a lot to counter that across the board with Safe Streets Task Force out of Charlotte and Raleigh, and certainly in DPS with GangNet and initiatives in DPS itself, as well as certainly prisons. I might add that we have developed two models inside prisons. We have some 5 or 6,000 certified or verified gang members in our inmate population of about 36,000. My math isn't good, but about one out of every seven inmates is in a gang at some level, even either co-opted or a foot soldier or a lieutenant or a leader. If you don't believe that's a major problem, ask those correctional officers who are attacked once every 11 hours on average. And so the answer to your question is North Carolina is a crossroads for gangs like never before.
You can, Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Yes, sir. Representative Stevens.
Thank you. And mine may be, I'm just looking at the organizational chart. And first question may be actually for staff is, I noticed the Private Protective Services Board and Alarm Systems Licensing Boards are under this agency, and I understand they previously were under some other agency, but at this point, how many private occupational licensing boards do we have that are actually under some state agency? That may be a Karen Cochran-Brown question. She's not here. Does anybody know the answer to that question? I just thought it odd. I've not seen them in that organizational type chart before.
I'm going to call on Christine Leggett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christine Leggett, Fiscal Research. Representative Stevens, the PPS and ALS were under DOJ previously, and they were transferred last year, the year before, I can't remember, but they were transferred from DOJ. The ABC Commission is also housed administratively under DPS. Most boards and commissions are housed administratively within agencies. That's how they receive their funds. So we can, but we can get you a list of how many there are and where they are and how they're governed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Follow up.
My bigger question, I guess, is why is the Coal Ash Commission under DPS and that, why?
Are you asking me, ma'am?
I think I'm asking whoever can answer that. Why is the Coal Ash Commission just, it was put there, or is there a specific DPS function to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevens, it's housed administratively within the Division of Emergency Management, and I think the legislature at the time had some thought that there was a correlation between emergency management and coal ash, but y'all chose to place it there. That was it was in the authorizing legislation that's where it would be housed.
Follow up.
And now I'll be happy to try to get to the basis, I think, of our committee meeting. Secretary Perry, have you seen the memorandum of October 16, 2015 about the permissibility of some organizations, and do you have any comment about that?
Is that October 14th, ma'am? Is there a different memo? Or
I don't know. The one that was handed out to us is dated October 16th.
I'm sorry. Is that the reorganization memo from DPS?
Yes, Secretary Perry.
Yes, ma'am. I've seen that.
Follow up.
I guess my question is, apparently our staff has done a memorandum to us that indicates that there may be some constitutional issues with combining the Division of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice into a single division, and I'm just wonder whether you've had some contrary legal advice, whether there's some notes you can share with us.
Yes, ma'am. I understand just recently that has come up as to why that was done in 2013, right after I became secretary. And We did it for a number of reasons, and I hope I didn't do it in a way that's contrary to the expectations of this body. It certainly was not intentional. We saw the need to share and implement savings and effectiveness with respect to pharmacy, with respect to mental health care, with respect to physical health care. And we consolidated them to have one internal affairs entity, for example, to address misconduct within our own ranks. And I saw that there was benefit from both agencies, nationally recognized experts in juvenile justice, that could collaborate with our own experts in adult corrections to simply make things better and fully implement justice reinvestment. So I was asked recently if what I did was indeed contrary to the wishes of this body. I was not aware that I was prohibited from making that consolidation. It's not clear to me from discussions with legal staff that I would be prohibited. I'd be happy to collaborate here to fix that if it should be fixed. But, ma'am, it's going well. But if it's inappropriate, I will revisit that.
Follow up, Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question then becomes to staff, is it inappropriate and is there something we need to do to fix it and make it right if that's in fact what needs to happen?
Sean Dale.
Yeah, I think our opinion is that either legislation would need to be enacted to combine the two because they're references throughout the statutes,
right.
Or the governor could do it by executive order under the Constitution. But one of those two would need to be done.
Yes, sir. I would appreciate any accommodation to leave what is in place, but we just need to do it the right way.
Thank you.
Is this microphone working? I take it it is. Okay.
Representative Stephen, do you have any other questions?
So I guess, thank you, Madam Chair. I think my question or comment would be that do we as a committee need to have a discussion on or have some more information on how and why this is appropriate or inappropriate, and do we need to take action, or does Ms. Secretary Perry need to seek something from the governor? I guess since it's here, we need to know what are we going to do with it.
Ma'am, may I kindly, Madam Chair?
Secretary Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my recollection that we have had presentations here on two occasions about this consolidation. And in fact, our strategic plan was asked for and we provided it. And in the content of that strategic plan was this consolidation. Without being discreet or otherwise, but being completely open, that this consolidation was wise for juveniles, for adults, and for our staff and mission and efficiencies. Adult corrections has a budget of $1.4 billion, juvenile $131 million. And those are significant numbers, but we thought we could consolidate those numbers, and that, just like in law enforcement, would be a force multiplier for the good, which in fact North Carolina has been recognized by the United States Department of Justice of all entities as leading the nation in the highest reduction of recidivism. And I think that that is in part to this collaborative effort within the department. I would submit that. I will correct what you demand.
Let me follow up.
Follow up.
I'm just looking at the legal analysis, and it says while changes were made to 143B806 in 2013, as you suggest, it gave the secretary the power to delegate powers and duties of the Division of Juvenile Justice, but that goes on to say we never specifically gave any statutory permission to abolish the Division of Juvenile Justice. You consolidated two divisions into one. And we said, basically, look for savings. And if that, I think it may be more of a technicality that yes, we ma'am. Do need to help you fix it, and we need to understand that. I'm assuming that's part of why we're here today. Is of all people, the people who make the laws should make sure that they're clean. They're clear. They're clean. The people who enforce the laws clearly want to know that they didn't exceed their authority. So, you know, if it's an issue of going back and getting authority, that's perhaps what we need to be looking at.
Thank you, Representative McNeil.
Well, I don't mean to digress from that discussion. If there's any more, I had a couple of different questions, if that's all right.
Proceed.
I want to go back to just a second to your comments about gangs in North Carolina.
Yes, sir.
I know there was a study that was ordered, I think, this past year, legislative. I think it was a combination study with the Highway Patrol and the SBI. Could you update us on where that study is, if you know, or if maybe there's someone else is? And then also, after that, my second question is, in your opening comments, you said you were about 85% through with the consolidations.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like just a little bit more information on that, dwell down into it a little bit.
I knew that would get me in trouble, but it's truthful. As for the gangs, we have worked with the SBI, and we decided it was a collaborative effort to move GangNet into the control and oversight, administratively at least, and as well as the analysis of GangNet. Who are these people? What gangs do they represent? Into the Highway Patrol. And so we have more immediate information for the trooper who's out at 2 in the morning and makes a single stop on a dark road as to who exactly this person is. And what we've done is taken GangNet and made it more accessible to local and state deputies and officers as well, to prevent violence, to prevent problems, so that they can engage in de-escalation of the conversation with a known gang member upon confrontation. And we have educated some 25,000 deputies and officers in that use. They have accessed that at the rate of 68 times per day statewide. So that is working, sir. And as far as the substance of what's in GangNet, we've augmented that too, pursuant to the study you're alluding to. We're becoming wiser with the help of the FBI and ATF and others as they look to us to help educate them. What is a gang? Who are they? What is their mission? There are gangs that are not traditional gangs. There are gangs that exist to destroy government, not terrorists, gangs. And so we want to know what type of gang they are. Are they traditional? Are they the really traditional motorcycle gang groups, more traditional inner city gang groups? Are they going out to other names? I prefer not to name any gang, because that's what they're looking for, is authenticity and celebrity. But there are gangs that are most non-traditional in their attempts to even target specific people in law enforcement, to target specific entities of government. And that is what we're up against, as I indicated, 68 times per day. I hope I've answered you with respect to the gangs.
Follow-up.
I have a follow-up. In relation to that study, and it sounds like you're doing a good job of collaborating on how to deal with gangs. As part of your study, are you looking at the criminal statutes of North Carolina to determine if we have the correct statutes in place? If we need new statutes maybe to deal with this gang, are the current statutes appropriate? Are you looking at issues such as the changes that were made into discovery laws several years ago that I think probably helped precipitate the Wake County incident that you're talking about? Are you looking at those issues in that study?
That is an excellent question. We should be. I believe that we are satisfied at the moment that the current state statutes that obtain in conjunction with the federal statutes with respect to RICO and organized crime are sufficient. But anything that you have, sir, on your mind or others in this body that would help us prevent their carrying out their plans would be most helpful. For example, well, I need not go into those here, but there are perhaps ways we can strengthen statutes that could prevent or deter their organization and collaboration and execution of their gang plans, especially those that want to undermine government.
Follow up, Representative McNeil.
Thank you. Well, yes, and I would be I would love to have a conversation with you or whomever you designate to look at that, because I think there are some deficiencies in the state statutes that probably need to be looked at.
I hear you, sir.
But that I'm good on that. Now back to my second question, I guess, is the 85%.
Yes, sir.
Where you're at and what's missing so far? What's the other 15%?
Things like auditing is fine. Internal auditing is across the board. It's completely consolidated. We have an excellent internal auditor that says essentially, physician, heal thyself. We have a huge department of 37,000 people. We don't want the state auditor who visits frequently, as she should, to find problems before we do. Sometimes she does. I'd like to know that internal audit, for example, has found them preemptively. We have instituted our own fraud, waste, and abuse hotline within DPS for that very reason. And she and I had a discussion about that, wondering if I was taking away her jurisdiction. Of course, the answer is no. We had a lighthearted conversation about that. But we're trying to prevent problems internally with respect to auditing. That's consolidated. Human resources, sir, is not quite where it ought to be. And we need to service adult corrections. We are doing that with them. We've had a backlog of vacancies, too many vacancies in adult corrections, which is demoralizing for the staff for any given shift when they are two COs light. That is a welcoming card for slashing and assaults. The gang member intelligence base in some cases is better than ours. They know who's there and who's not. So we're working with human resources, and we call it a RIO, regional employment officers, where we've joined forces in four districts with human resources, DPS, operators in adult corrections to beef up the hiring of correctional officers. That is about 6 months ongoing, and that is about at 85% fulfillment. We have, for the first time, one internal affairs system in this organization. It's called OSI. And again, we need to police ourselves. The Highway Patrol does an excellent job at doing that. In the month of August, the North Carolina Highway Patrol had zero internal affairs cases. We wanted to take their model, as well as some other models, and apply it to adult corrections and the fierce work they have and the culture in which they work and the influences and being co-opted the way they often tend to be to stop misconduct there. And those numbers have come down from about 1,600 per month to about 300. My point, sir, is that OSI is not fully consolidated. And I can name other instances like that, but as far as the controller's office, as far as budgeting, as far as legal counsel and liaison, I think those are 100% consolidated.
I have Representative Faircloth, Representative Daughtry, Representative Speciale, Senator Bingham. Do any of the four want to speak on this subject matter? Representative Speciale.
The subject matter being the corrections, right?
Sir?
I just want to know, do we have the figures of what you need to get corrections up where it needs to be? I mean, as far as personnel.
We need to fill the vacancies we have. And then we will come to you with those numbers. But we're having a hard time. The importance of what this body did in bringing a raise to these people, as I said, I will say it again for the first time in 30 years, do you think that has affected in a positive way recruitment? Yes, sir. But we need to bring them in and then get them trained. We have a backlog in training. That's why we have the implementation of SAMRCAN as far as a facility to train and train at a higher level. We will need things, sir, but let us fill the vacancies we have.
Follow up.
Is it could we? I guess this would be for staff. Could we get the information on where we're at right at this moment in time? I mean, as far as how many people short we are based on what the table of organization is.
Christine Leggett's going to answer that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Christine Leggett, Fiscal Research. Representative Speciale, do you mean how many people they how they're staffed in human resources? Or just general how they're staffed?
Corrections, the corrections personnel, people working in the prisons, how short are we?
Okay, we can, we'll get that information for you and get back to you, and we'll send it to the whole committee when we get it.
Follow up? Representative Speciale, you're good? Okay. So next on the list is Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. May I ask of you, first, if this October 16th memo that we are discussing, Madam Chair.
Excuse me.
This October 16th memo that we're discussing also contains some information about the SAMRCAN situation. Are we going to discuss that before we make some comments on this memo, or should we go ahead with
the memo and those issues regarding the Department of Public Safety are before us at this time? Yes, sir. And then we have a separate presentation on the update on the progress at SAMRCAN. So do you want to follow up and proceed?
I want to make some comments on the October 16th memo, but I think we should hear what's in here about SAMRCAN first.
Please proceed. So you're wanting to hold your question until we do the SAMRCAN presentation? The memo. You want someone to address the memo as to SAMRCAN?
Yeah, it's the part of the SAMRCAN information that is in his memo.
Yes. Call on Sean Dale.
I'm going to refer to Ben on that.
Ben Stanley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ben Stanley, Bill Drafting. The short answer about what the memo says about SAMRCAN is it refers to budget language in Section 16A.4 that required that the SAMRCAN facility be assigned to the Office of the Secretary and that the that office have oversight of SAMRCAN. And our understanding is that SAMRCAN has, in fact, been placed elsewhere.
Madam Chair,
Secretary Perry.
May I respond? I understand that confusion given the org chart. Of course, was not intentional. The question arose for me, what is the Office of the Secretary? How deep does that go? It's my understanding that reasonable people, including attorneys, can disagree on what is the office of the secretary. It's my understanding the statute does not say a direct report to me. Is that right, sir?
What it says is that facility is to be in the office of the secretary and that the office of the secretary has to exercise oversight, not a division head or any other
understood.
Employee of the department.
I placed it where I did. And let me say up front, I will revisit that placement. I placed it where I did because we have a model with our civil engineer who serves the entire department to include the Highway Patrol Academy. But he is in the Division of Adult Corrections administratively. my view, I take it my view was mistaken, that a direct report to a direct report to me is indeed in the office of the secretary. If that's my mistake, I will fully revisit what you intend.
Representative Faircloth, do you have further comment or question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I think we've gotten to the point of both of our problems within this particular memo, and I think it's poor communications. I think we probably, as a legislative group, could have communicated our thoughts better. I think we feel certainly that you could have handled yours a little differently as well. I don't see that in any way you're trying to stampede over us and form some type of organization that we certainly would disagree with. I think there's a desire on both of our parts to work this out. My main question here is why legal minds in the same neighborhood here in your shop and legal minds in our shop couldn't have reviewed this first and resolved these. So I think it's a lesson for all of us
yes,
to
sir.
Learn. And I'm sure we are willing to work within that framework.
Rest assured, I am too, sir.
And I also have one other question, if I might, Madam Chair. I know that the connection of gang enforcement to the highway patrol precedes the highway patrol moving to your shop, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Certainly the patrol during the stop, as you know, giving your resume, will address any crime pursuant to that stop. And if they see gang symbols or these days an ISIS flag, there are other things that follow up to that, but they have to be relied upon because they are statewide and we have so many of them, as opposed to the FBI or even the SBI, as the eyes and ears as to not only gangs, but looking in the back seat for an abused child and that sort of thing. So their training now covers a lot of areas, not getting away from their primary jurisdiction, but they are our eyes and ears for the most part. In fact, and I hope I'm answering your question, but their purview of gang activity, scrutiny of it and reporting of it, and indeed being on task forces in the past, predates me.
Follow up. Thank you, sir. The reason I asked that question is because most of our citizens in North Carolina would view the job of the highway patrol to patrol the highways. And I would feel there's about all they can do out there doing that particular job. I just want to feel comfortable as a citizen and as a legislator that we are not detracting from the life-saving work that our troopers do out there on the highway by saddling them with yet another chore that
yes,
doesn't
sir.
Seem to fit in.
I understand.
So I'm sure you're working on how that should work together, but it is a concern.
May I briefly, Madam Chair, explain that balance?
Please.
Last year, state troopers were involved in 956,000 cases. That's an increase of 6% over the previous year. That's highway cases, not gang cases. A 6% increase over the previous year. DWIs, 21,000, a 9% increase over last year. Seatbelt violations, 108,000, 3% increase over the previous year. They are growing more into their original jurisdiction. But because of the access they have, they need to report, not investigate, but report sightings of gang activity, traditional crime, crimes against children, terrorism, all of that back to the right people. Does that take away from their main mandate? No, sir. Now, with those numbers, sadly, in North Carolina, we did have, to answer your question, an increase in fatalities last year. It's 4.8% over the previous year. but I would call attention to the national average increase was 14%. Those men and women are doing their job.
Follow up. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Mr. Secretary, I'd like to just follow up, and then other people have a question on Samarkand. We had talked about the restructuring of the reporting, but also what about the direction we gave as far as the position and the HR of that position? Has that been executed?
Secretary Perry.
The position, sir, of the director? I believe that has been, sir. We just, if I may say, increased his classification because of his increase in duties at Samarkand. And he was afforded an appropriate raise because of those duties evolving. And I hope that we have done precisely what you're asking about, because he is a director. And we brought him in line with other directors and their salaries. He has a very important job. He's here, former federal agent that he is, and he's doing an outstanding job. And if we're failing him in any way, I want to know about it.
Follow up. You're good. Representative Daughtry.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Secretary Perry, I'm not here to say whether the elimination of the Division of Juvenile Justice and the reorganization is good or bad, because I do not know. But what worries me, though, is it says in this document that the reorganization that affects existing law within the meaning of the Constitution, it must satisfy the requirements of that section in order to be valid. In order to be valid. So if your elimination and reorganization of the department is not valid, and according to this, it is not valid, then what are we going to do if we go forward with an invalid reorganization according to the Constitution? I think you lay yourself open for lawsuits and other problems, and I don't know what we need to do to fix it to where it will be a valid operation as opposed to an invalid operation. And that's my concern. My concern is that the violation of the Constitution, if in fact you are violating, and this says you are, then what you're doing is that section is, in order to be valid, requires the governor and so forth to make a certain submissions to the General Assembly. And so we may have a situation that needs some attention because of the violation of the Constitution. And what is your remarks about that?
Well, sir, I'm confused on a couple of things, and certainly your response and comments and questions are well received. I don't understand why it took 2.5 years for this to come up, and we have, as I said, been over here twice with presentations about that plan, which included that consolidation. It's not clear to me why there's a question of this move being unconstitutional. I'm not aware of anything in Article 3, Section 5, Sub 10 that says that we cannot consolidate in the executive branch a particular division within a department. It's my understanding, I am not an attorney, that had to do with things like the governor recently brought to this body, and it was approved, the establishment of an Office of Information Technology and an Office of Veterans Affairs. It's my understanding, sir, that intent in the Constitution went one way but not the other. I need clarification on that. As Mr. Faircloth indicated, we need to get together and see. That was not intentional, for heaven's sake. That was not intentional.
Representative Daughtry.
Of course, I understand it was not intentional, but it says, and if I'm reading this memo, it says, in this case, none of the constitutional requirements have been met. And the requirements must be met in order for that section to be valid.
Yes, sir.
So that's my concern.
Yes, sir.
And I'm not saying that it's wrong or right or anything else.
Yes, sir.
If there is a violation of our Constitution, you might lay yourself open to
I understand. I take it that that violation would be the EO to this body for approval. Is that the mechanism?
I'm going to call on Ben Stanley. I think Ben has some input into Representative Daughtry's question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ben Stanley, Bill Drafting. The short answer to the question is if both the executive branch and the legislative branch are in agreement that this merger should go forward, the constitutional language doesn't stand in the way of a bill that would clean this up. What the constitutional language addresses is executive reorganization. So if there is a will to ratify this after the fact, a bill could be drafted to do that. That would not have any constitutional problems. Does that answer? Does that sort of cut through some of this?
Follow up, Representative Daughtry.
To the staff, but we don't have this. We're not in session right now. We are between the long session and the short session, and we have this issue. How do we resolve this issue at the present time?
Ben Stanley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure there is a way since the legislature is not in session right now. What the constitutional language talks about is when there is a reorganization, it's supposed to be set forth in an executive order, and then that executive order is not to take effect until the General Assembly adjourns sine die, ratifies the executive order, or modifies it through legislation. So really there's no scenario for getting this done that doesn't involve it coming through the legislature. While the legislature is not in session, that of course is not possible.
One final question for
follow
Ben.
Up.
The question is, if nothing is done, what is the, I mean, obviously nobody can complain, but what if someone complains? Do we lay ourselves open to a constitutional challenge?
Mr. Stanley.
I'm not sure who would have standing to challenge it. And that doesn't mean that nobody would. I just don't know who would. That's really all I have to say about that.
Representative Dahl. Senator Bingham, is your question or comment in regards to this issue?
No, ma'am.
Okay, if you will hold your question or concern.
Madam
Secretary Perry.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, for the attorneys, could that be grandfathered and therefore fixed?
I think we're going to take care of this right now. We're going to begin working on it.
Okay.
As the chair, I'm going to entertain a motion to instruct staff to draft any necessary corrective legislation to be considered at our February 11th meeting. From someone. Looks like Representative Stevens is making the motion, and I need a second. Representative Spashali. Those in favor say aye. Any opposing? So, staff, if you will please prepare us some corrective language. Thank you.
Senator Beamer. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and I appreciate you resolving that problem. It's your, we need a lot of brilliant legal scholars, and we got them in this room, so thank you for doing that. Now, question.
Madam Chair, point of order, please, before I guess we proceed.
Yes, Representative Stevens.
And I don't mind, but can Representative Spashali second a motion if he's only an advisory member?
You know what? You are correct. And I'm sorry, Representative Spashali, I cannot allow that second. So would somebody else please second? So Representative Hurley, those again in favor say aye. Those opposing? No. Thank you. Senator Bingham, excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Now back to things I think the public is very much interested in, and that being terrorist threats that we all have concerns about, starting with the Boston bombings on and on and on. And I know we have international events here in this state with car races, et cetera, et cetera. Is DPS prepared for these kind of activities, et cetera, or would you want to comment on that, Secretary Perry?
not as well as we should be. And there is no finish line in that race. It's serious. I need not go into that unless you want me to, but North Carolina, every major terrorist event in this country has had a North Carolina tie. 11% of all ISIL arrests have been in North Carolina. And we only have so many people to work those cases. So the force multiplier for the safety of your family and mine, your neighbors and mine, is that there be collaboration, task forces, communication, MEMEX, case management, both human sources, both collaboration of deputies, officers, agents, troopers, to implement what I'm talking about is serious business, preventive intelligence-based law enforcement. And what the FBI calls terrorism, if it happens here at the state building, God forbid, what we in DPS and the SBI and other state agencies call it is at best destruction of state property, at worst murder. It's everybody's problem. And your first responders will not be Homeland Security. Have you ever met a Homeland Security agent? Have you? And I'm not sure if I have. And it's a great organization. We work with them from afar. But the first responders in San Bernardino were deputies and officers and firemen. The first responders from our department would be troopers, emergency management, and others. So we need to prevent gangs, traditional crime, crimes against children, drugs, cartels, underage drinking, terrorism. There's a blur here from one end to the other as to what is and is not terrorism. But just because the FBI calls it terrorism, it doesn't mean we back off and it's their problem. It's our problem.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Secretary Perry, the incident that I was referring to, I wasn't specific enough, was U.S. Open. I know there was hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people here, and it was my understanding that DPS had the security, et cetera. Are you familiar, I don't remember the time frame, whether you are familiar or not, or would you comment on this?
Yes, sir. Year before last, and it was the first time, as you know, down at Pinehurst, that the men's event was followed by the women's event. It was a double-decker major incident to prepare for, prevent. We had, for the first time ever, a JOC, Joint Operations Center, should something happen. But we had an IOC, Intelligence Operations Center. We had 475 people at both from ALE, SBI, FBI, Homeland Security, troopers, deputies, officers, working as one under DPS guidance. That model is now the model, and last year, the Washington State Police, where the event was held last year, asked that we come out and show them how to do it. This year, it's in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania State Police have said, come show us how to do it. It's the preventive model. And over 42 episodes were prevented in Pinehurst that people will never know about. From stalking to environmental groups that wanted to travel even from London to interfere even with violence at that occasion. This model is not theory, it works, and that was a case where everybody came together as a force multiplier. Nobody elbowed anybody out of the way, and they did a great job.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I may ask this just as a curiosity, but you mentioned 42 events at Pinehurst. And the reason for the publicity or the public not knowing of those events and the good outcome that came from that, is it because of your mention of not giving notoriety to gangs and other things, or what, why would not the public be made aware of that?
Some had to do with specific violations of court orders. We had one that was a violator out of Oregon that had a restraining order against him, against a female golfer, and he was there dressed in a disguise, and he was apprehended as a stalker. Two other groups, not gangs in this case, but environmental terrorists who wanted to do certain things to certain organizations and companies represented at Pinehurst. And a lot of that was picked up by methods that are technical. I'm proud of that result. Thank you.
I'm going to call on Representative Bowles, and I think if there's not any other questions, that's going to excuse me, one more. So Representative Bowles and then Representative McNeil.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just a couple questions, concerns. You keep mentioning about the gang, and I guess we still have fusion centers.
Yes, here, sir. Yes, sir.
Which were created to open communications after 9/11 between the and are you in charge of appointing anybody on these fusion centers?
Yes, sir. We've increased the numbers there fivefold. I'm not in charge of the fusion center. By legislation last session, you've fully removed, and rightly so. There was, if I may, sir, session before last, there was a hybrid placement of the fusion center known as ISAC, Information Sharing and Analysis Center, partly in DPS and partly by the SBI. The SBI now fully runs that. But separation of, I suppose, powers is that they run it. We have beefed it up with analysts for safer school initiatives. We want to prevent violence on school campuses. We're beefing that up, and other entities are helping beef up that with analysts and operators. The FBI is there, Homeland Security is there, troopers are there. What that is to help us prevent crime like we did down at Pinehurst. But they report the results to me as Homeland Security Advisor.
Okay.
Follow up.
Thank you. And I guess I'm getting to the point where it sounds like that we already have, I guess you call it, ISAC in place as the direction of the SBI.
Yes, sir.
Correct. And I guess what I'm hearing you say that we also, in conjunction, we have the fusion centers here, which communicate channels between the FBI, the state, the local law enforcement, and in North Carolina. And for terrorism investigation, who is the lead law enforcement agency in North Carolina?
Well, we're all associated with the FBI's Terrorism Task Force. The JTTF has troopers on it. I'm not sure anymore about SBI. SBI may be on the JTTF. I'm not sure. But you mentioned ISAC and the Fusion Center. ISAC, as you know, is the North Carolina Fusion Center. And though run by the SBI, 80% of the information they get is from troopers.
Follow up.
Yes, thank you. I guess I'm concerned, as Representative Faircloth has indicated, how many state troopers do we have in the state?
About 1,600 is my last assessment.
And when was the last time that we even had a new trooper added?
We had a graduation.
I'm talking about, it's always been 1,600.
Yes, sir. We know we're not getting any. The cavalry's not coming. We're not getting 1,000 more troopers, I understand that.
Okay. And I guess, you know, my concern is that I would just hope that DPS, in the limited that we do have, and you do, and they do a great job, is that we already have a
a flow, Isaac, yes, which is, I think, Phil Lazon,
yes, sir,
across the state, that's comprised of local and state agencies. And I think you keep saying that we're – I guess my main concern was you stated in the News Observer that we eliminated a position and that it's going to cause us to have concerns for an increase in terrorism, and that this General Assembly handicapped you in making that decision, and that North Carolina citizens are at a greater risk now because we don't have that one position out of, and you mentioned 37,000 people in your department.
Yes,
is what you testified, and by eliminating that one, the terrorism threat went up. And that there are, and to me, we have over 400 field liaisons in the state with over 50 agencies represented. Is that correct? Or
we have about 400, about 200 of those are troopers. It is, that's correct.
Okay. And was this a start after you became secretary?
We've doubled it since I've been on board.
But this was already in place?
It was mandated after 9/11.
Okay, thank you. And follow up on...
May I respond, sir?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
I'm fine. Thank
Secretary
you.
Perry.
That position was the hub for all the spokes that you just mentioned. Isaac is simply one communicator of danger to implement the predictive intelligence-based law enforcement that we have in North Carolina that no other state has. I got a call last week from the governor's office of Nebraska. Help us form a DPS like you have with that model. And so the position that was taken, one of those 37,000, was the very one that had everybody at the table, SBI, ALE, State Capitol Police. Never underestimate the police force here under Chief Weaver and their mandate. Never underestimate the State Capitol Police. Should something happen, they're at the tip of the bayonet, not Homeland Security, not the FBI. And we have to remember that these are the people that need to sit at the table as co-equals, not subordinates to another law enforcement entity, but as co-equals around the table where that commissioner that you're referring to, sir, and I understand we may disagree on that, but that commissioner was the one that made everybody equal. Commander of the Highway Patrol is an excellent commander, nationally recognized organization, elite as it is, but when he comes here, he's advocating for the equities of the Highway Patrol. We needed someone to have everyone at the table, to include Isaac, only a part of that group around the table, to implement predictive law enforcement. It's not a theory. It's what we needed.
Follow up.
Yeah, follow up. And you had mentioned that in your the commissioner of law enforcement, in our flow chart that you presented to us before you reorganized everything, that he was in charge as far as law enforcement. There were just a highway patrol and the State Capitol Police. And I understand that. And since we've technically eliminated the law enforcement division, has the highway patrol had a negative consequence with the elimination of the commissioner of law enforcement?
Secretary Perry.
I believe that we have lessened the impact of the other force multipliers being at the table. Yes. Now, the chart, and I don't know which chart you have.
The one you presented to
us. Okay. Safer schools was under the law enforcement mandate. Emergency management was under the law enforcement mandate. ALE before, in fact, what was done session before last was brilliant in that ALE was still on board, and SBI was a hybrid, and we had these entities all as co-equals. So the law enforcement commissioner, before certain activity was done, had and still has, as commissioner of operations, these important elements of law enforcement. PPSB, Safer School Initiative, Emergency Management, and other entities that are so important, to include the governor's crime control. All of that is under that person. But there was a time before, sir, we evolved, and I understand what you mean and where you're going with this, and I respect that. But there was a time where we had SBI, ALE, State Capitol Police, Highway Patrol, ISAC, Emergency Management, Safer School, not too long ago, at the same table to implement prevention of crime.
Follow up.
Yes, I'd just like to follow up on another couple of things as far as the...
The mic is yours.
Thank you. The reorganization. Can you kind of elaborate of why you saw the need and that with your regal organization was not a, I guess it's not going against the General Assembly. It was nothing personal against us. And as far, and what the qualifications, because there were two positions that were released, and I do respect that this is your department and for you to manage, but you release a general counselor that had over 25 years experience, and then another gentleman which has served as a deputy secretary of crime control under some past administrations with a lot of experience in administration and accounting. And I guess, can you explain in the qualifications of our new, I guess you call this position now, Commissioner of Operations, and why the COO title was changed? Was there concerns of being able to meet those qualifications?
Secretary Perry.
Yes, sir. First of all, the COO was not changed. I just didn't fill it.
And it,
I do not
follow it. Did it still open?
No, sir. We used that position to fill a much needed role in the Safer School Initiative. It was reclassified to saving $87,000 just in doing that, so that we could train SROs and to help protect the schools across the state. We had a backlog of schools asking for training with respect to run, hide, and fight, as well as SRO training. And this body was good enough to give us money for that training, and we needed to not have a backlog in Franklin County, for example, and during that time have a shooting on one of those campuses. We had to expedite the training. We used that position. I never filled it. I do not have a number two. As far as those individuals you mentioned, very good people, very bright people, but I had to look at what I was given, and we are not the Department of Administration. Those individuals were quite adept and had grand resumes with administration, but we needed operations, and we are operational. And so I had to make the decision, do we keep people who are adept at operations, or do we keep people who are adept at administration? And I made the choice that I did.
And just a follow up, maybe Christine can help. I understand operations and administration. We control the dollars.
Yes,
who's controlling your dollars if that's not a priority to you?
If what's not a priority, sir?
Yeah, you had mentioned you're not going to fill the chief operating officer.
Oh, I see. No.
And
no.
That the only thing that you want want operations instead of administration. The administration, to me, controls the dollars.
Oh, they're well controlled.
Those and under dollars, what supervision?
Yes, sir. A former FBI agent who's a CPA, and they are very well controlled.
And that CPA is?
Jim Shirok. And, sir, if I suggested that I'm not interested in saving money, what I thought I said was I had to weigh being heavy on the administrative side, not being fiscally conservative and judicious and a steward that I ought to be. That is not what I meant. I meant overall administration, that is HR, that is general counsel, that is all of those things, and purchasing and payroll and the controller's office. And I had to make a decision. We're fine there. I need operations. There's only one other person that has a clearance in DPS to talk to these entities to help stop these problems that we have, and that is now the Commissioner of Operations. As Homeland Security Advisor, I need someone else who has a clearance to talk about these things that help protect us all. That's operations.
Thank you. And so you only have one clearance in DPS?
In upper management.
Mr. Baker?
No, I have one, and he has one in operations.
Okay.
And in upper management. The National Guard obviously has their clearances, and we have two people in emergency management. But as far as upper management, one.
And I'd just like to make a comment that I appreciate what you said, because when we have to look at a budget, we have to look at a budget as well. And the actions that we took are no negativity toward your organization. And so when I think the position of Commissioner of Law Enforcement was released out of the budget, to us it's a fiscal responsibility to look at things, and that's how we react. There was nothing on our intention of otherwise. We have very confidence in our colonel with the Highway Patrol, which I think reports to you, and the Capitol, State Capitol Police. And how many officers do they have?
We have about 56 there, but a lot of those are receipt funded.
Right, in which we felt like that 56 added to the colonel, since he hadn't had any new troopers in the last 20 years, maybe.
No, sir, that doesn't compute, respectfully.
Right. But
that doesn't help the patrol at all.
But as far as administratively, we were able to. I think you could. But I guess that was my concern is the qualifications of the operations of the and the restructuring. And
may I just respectfully respond?
I'm
Secretary Perry.
Sir, I know there was nothing personal. In fact, I didn't know that this was coming at all. And the first person I called was you. I said, what is this and why? The second person I called was a member of this group. Then I finally visited in person with the Madam Chair. And she assured me there was not an issue with that person or with DPS. It had to do with consolidation. Kindly include me in collaboration with respect to what ought to be consolidated and deleted. That is an important part of our mission. And as far as that person's qualifications, he had managed an FBI office. He had managed drug cases nationally from Cleveland to San Juan, from New York to Miami. He had worked kidnappings. He had worked it all. Most importantly, recently, InfraGuard, where we would go into companies in this fine state and asks if we could come on board and enter into their computer network to prevent hacking, or at least stop the hacking that they had seen. And this person has done a wide variety of that work of both administration, but with respect to operations, administration and operations. So I had to make a decision, and it was not impulsive, and it was not personal, what is good for DPS in particular and public safety in general. And I did that.
And the follow-up, I do keep important text messages, and you did Monday, September the 14th. We did talk about it, yes, and sir. I've got it right here.
Yes, sir.
So, I think just to be clear, ISIS is one of our is our intelligence agency, one of them.
ISIC,
and it's under the direction of the SBI. Correct.
Yes, sir, but staffed, and there's a collaboration with DPS,
right,
and others.
I think I've got a list of all the information sharing, which I assume the SBI, it includes the FBI, Homeland Security, State Highway Patrol, our North Carolina National Guard, ALE, probation, parole, Apex Police Department, North Carolina State University Police, all share in this investigation.
Yes, sir, as well as other analysts that may not be listed there from the Guard, from emergency management, as well as from Safer School.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Representative McNeil.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't have a question. I have a request of the chairs. The gang report that I had mentioned earlier, I think by statute is due by March the 1st to this committee. I'd just like to make sure and ask the chairs that they put that on the agenda for our March meeting, that we could review that report.
So done.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Charles Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for Secretary Perry. You mentioned earlier that you have identified many hundreds or several gangs in our state. Do you have information of the number of gangs identified in our public schools, middle school to high school? Do you have that kind of data?
Secretary Perry, or do you have someone on your staff that...
No, ma'am. I want not to disclose certain things, I'm thinking. I would say generally that every gang of the 314 that are currently active in GangNet, most of those are active in our public schools. Those that deal with the overthrow of the government are not, and please respect my request that I not name any of them. They love the glory. But all of the traditional non-biker gangs, Hells Angels, Bandidos over here, then into the more serious violent gangs in the middle, then those involved with the overthrow of the government, those in the middle are, sir, represented in our schools. They're represented roughly at the rate of 50% with respect to 50% of those gang members are with one gang, which I prefer not to name.
Follow up. When you say at least half of those are in our public schools, that's alarming. That's scary. We're talking about our children. We're talking about individuals who are there for another purpose, in my opinion. And I'm looking at the Center for Safe Schools, and we touched on this a few minutes ago. What is their role when we're talking about keeping our children safe, protecting our children from this type of activity? And I know, serving on this committee for the past several years, we have closed juvenile detention centers. We are seeing the bed space is not needed. I'm really concerned when we're sitting here saying we got a problem in our public schools and we've got juveniles who are not there for the purpose of learning. And it really bothers me to have this knowledge today, looking at the most valuable resource we have in our state, and just, and I'm not saying you're just, this is not being taken lightly. I think it's a serious problem that we need to address as a committee. And we've had discussions about gangs before. We've talked about this before. I've really not seen any specific action from this committee or now the Department of Public Safety to address this problem. If we need to go back, and I think that we need to go back and look at this because it is, we have a safe schools officer. Do we need to heighten our alert, heighten our senses to this matter, and do more about it? Because I don't see it going away. It's a problem in my district, and I know it's a problem in other 100-plus districts across the state. So I just wanted to bring that to our attention here as a committee. It certainly is a concern of mine, and I hope, you know, future discussions that we can come back to this. I take this as a serious threat to our security and to our youth. Thank you.
Well said, sir. Just briefly, we've gone from estimates of 1% of our youth being involved with gangs to 2%. There are very good mitigation efforts. We have one in DPS in Morganton. It's been very successful to de-gang gang members. There is one out of New Hanover County. The sheriff's office down there is doing a great job called Elements. And Charlotte has a great program called Gang of One. There are success stories, and our community programs in adult corrections is doing all they can to isolate those who do want to leave on their own. Let me just say, as far as gangs in schools, a lot of those are wannabes. They want the attention of gang members. They act like gang members. Then they evolve into the markings and to the behavior. Hopefully, we can stop them from committing a crime. But as far as representation in public schools, the answer is yes, they are there.
Just to follow up.
Follow up.
The programs you mentioned are certainly model, I would think, model programs. But there's a concern I have in that statement. These are urban school districts. I'm talking about rural school districts that don't have the capability of some of those urban districts and don't have the resources that some of those urban districts have. And that is a serious concern of mine, is our rural school districts. It just doesn't, they don't have that networking capability. They don't have those resources. Thank you.
Sir, you understand this well. And accolades to you. Last week, I spoke at the gang conference in Mount Olive. And it was precisely the individuals you're talking about that came up and asked, do we have funds, Madam Chair, to help them establish a gang unit in certain rural areas? We do have that through the Governor's Crime Commission. And hopefully we can be more alert and aggressive with seeking federal funding and direct those funds to where they're needed in those rural areas. Well said, sir.
So we do have the gang on our agenda for the March meeting when we can receive the report, and we will have a full discussion at the meeting. So we have already instructed staff. So thank you. Other questions from the committee?
I have one follow-up.
Representative Bowles.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I have one follow-up that it may have been addressed in the General Assembly or Executive. The ability of officers to share the computer tech, the information. Has that been resolved?
Yes, sir. And you've been on top of that, to your credit.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but
yes, you have.
If I have, I'd have known if it would pass.
We got it done, and we have CJ Leeds now, and that is a database, as all know here, of people. But what we need now is a higher order, and that's what we're asking with asset forfeiture money to provide. We're not asking that of you yet, but we need MEMEX, which is a case consolidated database. We have people, precisely what you're asking for. We have that now, and it's under control. It's where it ought to be. And with the collaboration with ALE and the SBI and the Highway Patrol, we want to go one step higher for case management. What does that mean? Trooper at 2 in the morning, deputy, whatever, they not only pull up CJ Leeds and get the person's profile, they can see who's working this person case-wide, statewide.
And just one follow-up. The local law enforcement has already had it.
Yes, sir.
Our state troopers don't. Do they have it now?
Yes, sir.
So they are able to communicate between South Carolina and North Carolina. And
let me double check on that very important point.
Because
I don't know about interstate. I don't know about interstate. Staff?
Because it was disturbing that our troopers could not communicate when the Charleston gunman, because we did not have software capable. There was administrative about who was going to do what.
We have the voice capability, but you're talking about CJ Leeds capability.
Right.
I will check on that, sir, rather than
because I know we were working on it, and yes, I was hoping, because you as an executive could have addressed it, and I was hoping that it has been addressed either legislatively or administratively.
It is. Let me check on the full capability if that's been unpacked. Thank you for that.
Secretary Perry, if you will provide that information to Christine Leggett and let her get it out to all the members.
Yes, I will.
Are there other questions for Secretary Perry? Seeing none, thank you, Secretary Perry, for coming.
Thank you.
And we will see you next month when we have our draft legislation. So the next item, SAMRCAN Training Academy update, John Poteet, and then from the department would be Richard Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a quick handout about the budget history of the SAMRCAN Training Academy. In 2013, you all appropriated $10.4 million to begin renovating the SAMRCAN Training Academy down in Moore County. The major things that happened last session was you appropriated $1.9 million in operating costs and funded 21 positions. You also appropriated $2.9 million for a state-of-the-art firing range down at SAMRCAN. And most importantly, we have notified Uzbekistan that we have changed the traditional spelling of SAMRCAN, and we're trying to head off an international incident, but I'm not sure if we'll be successful doing that. It is now spelled with a C, not the traditional K, but we'll move on from that incident.
So, Richard, are you going to put slides up, John?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So we have the director of the SAMRCAN, Richard. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, I just want to take a quick moment and thank you for inviting me here to make this presentation on behalf of SAMRCAN Training Academy. But more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your support in the last assembly session in which you funded many of the things that we're accomplishing down there at SAMRCAN. I've got a short PowerPoint presentation I'd like to show you and hopefully answer many questions you might have. Our mission statement mirrors that of the public safety mission statement, primarily that we'd like to provide a training facility that enhances and encourages the ability of the men and women of DPS to learn and develop the skills necessary to safeguard and preserve the lives and property of the people of North Carolina. The Training Academy was established to conduct basic in-service and advanced training programs for the Division of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice, for DPS law enforcement agencies, and for other local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies as well. We're on 430 acres there in Moore County. We originally opened, as many of you are aware, as a juvenile detention facility in 1918. And then the legislature closed Samarkand in 2011 because of budget cuts and reduced juvenile population. Samarkand is administered by a director, and the academy and the director are assigned to the office of the Secretary of the Department of Public Safety. Currently, for DPS administrative oversight, Samarkand reports directly to the Commissioner of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice. Our staffing model at Samarkand currently, we have a director. We have a business officer that is working part-time and is temporary. We have a housekeeper, which is full-time and temporary. These positions are temporary and were filled so that we could get up and running. The legislature afforded us seven positions full-time, and we're in the process of interviewing, selecting, establishing those positions, which you see up on the screen. Hopefully, we'll be fully staffed by late spring with all seven positions. In addition to staff that are currently assigned to the academy, we also have an instructor staff that's assigned to the Department of Public Safety, Adult Correction, Office of Staff Development Training. We currently have three instructors, a supervisor, and a processing assistant. Also in the appropriations bill was additional staffing that will be filled in 2016 that includes nine more additional instructor positions, as well as maintenance staff that we have assigned to Samarkand. They actually belong to regional maintenance or maintenance facilities, but they're assigned and permanently at Samarkand to assist us with grounds and other maintenance issues. Phase one, which was originally funded in the 2013 session, is $10.4 million. The original scope for that money was to renovate 14 buildings, to renovate electrical, water, and sewer infrastructure, to provide 89 bedrooms, 6 classrooms, a cafeteria, a gymnasium with psychomotor skills training area, or a mat room, and the construction of a basic 12-lane firing range. That was in the initial appropriation. This is an overview of Samarkand. It's difficult to see, but you can basically see this encompasses most of the 430 acres. The squares on the right in the photo is where the ranges will be located, where our firearms training center. The center campus is where most of the administrative and academic functions will take place. And then the lower campus is where our dormitories are located. Phase one, part one. The initial building that was turned over and completed was the administrative building with 7 offices, conference room, a lobby reception area, display cases for our artifacts. And this was completed in July, and we have occupied that building since then. These are some before photos. You can see the construction that took place. Essentially, it was stripped down to bare walls and the roof. That's all that was left. And this is where we are today. The lobby area, the hallways leading to the staff offices, and then one of our display cases in the lobby that has Samarkand artifacts that we've been able to collect and hold on to and display. And this is the administrative conference room. Again, we have another display there of additional artifacts. The second building that was turned over to us in July was our gymnasium, which also contained one classroom. There's a mat room for psychomotor skills or unarmed self-defense training. There's a weapons armory. We also have a training cell for correctional officers to conduct cell extractions and searches during their basic training class. This is the gymnasium classroom as it went through renovation. And then the bottom right slide or picture is how it looks today. This is the gymnasium with the mat room or mat flooring. You can see where it was in the left-hand corner compared where it is today. The armory, this is where the correctional training staff stores sensitive equipment. And then the training cell that I inferred is used for training for correctional officers in cell extraction and searches. We had that mock-up built and placed in the gymnasium so that they can go through various training and develop skill sets. The third building as part of part one is the academic building and our auditorium. It has a new roof. It has four classrooms. Each classroom can hold up to 24 students. It has a fifth classroom that's comprised of a computer or e-learning with 24 PCs. We have separate student and instructor break rooms. We have two instructor offices. We have an auditorium that can seat up to 350 people. And we just took possession of that building at the end of December. This is the academic building before it was remodeled. And I actually can remember snow on those floors last December. This is how it looks today. Classrooms before, classrooms today. The auditorium before it was remodeled, the auditorium today. The roof, which was a major undertaking, and how it looks today. The site work. We had to have all new water lines installed at Samarkand, 8-inch water line pipes throughout the entire campus. They're all installed and functioning well. That was part one. It released three buildings to us. We are in occupancy of those three buildings. I'll talk a little bit in a minute about the classes we've already held, but we've been conducting classes at Samarkand since August. Part two is what's under renovation now, today, as I speak. The Mitchell Dormitory and Mitchell Cafeteria will be released to us in February. It has 21 bedrooms. It has a cafeteria that will seat up to 75 to 80 people at a single seating. We take delivery of that in February. We plan to have overnight students on campus the 1st of April. The Fry Dormitory has 39 bedrooms. We've also added a mat room down there in that area. We'll have that building in June. Norden Dormitory, which is the third dormitory on the campus, another additional 34 bedrooms. We'll have that building in September. Additional buildings. We have administrative buildings that have not been renovated yet, which will house additional staff instructors. We have the basic firing range that they have started working on that will have 12 lanes, stationary targets, still bullet traps out to 50 yards. It'll be ready in August. And then the campus life building, which is another dormitory for overnight visiting instructors, be ready in November. So as of November 2016, we will be finished with phase one, the $10.4 million. And what we will have is a training facility that can accommodate 94 trainees in overnight accommodations in five buildings, 10 overnight instructors, six classrooms capable of training 144 students, a cafeteria capable of feeding 75 trainees, three psychomotor skill mat rooms, and a basic firearms range up to 12 lanes. A second major part is what the General Assembly gave us this year, and that's a state-of-the-art tactical component firearms training range up to 24 lanes out to 300 yards. This was a critical component in providing adequate firearms training facility for our law enforcement agencies in DPS. It includes an impact area consisting of steel bullet traps backstopped by a 20-foot high concrete cinder block wall and a screw conveyor system, collection system for the expended lead. What's critical about this collection system is no lead, no bullets go into the ground. There is no contamination of the groundwater. It's environmentally safe. We don't have to shut down the range to migrate the lead from the dirt. And we actually can sell the used lead back to a reclamation company. We have inverted turning targets with a computerized operating system housed in a range control tower that will be utilized to run the range and oversee the safety of the operators when they're shooting. A 3,000 square foot range house consisting of a 24-person classroom, restrooms, a range office, a weapons cleaning room, and a room for the use of force simulator. We also have a specialized lighting system that's being designed that will be implemented for law enforcement corrections officers who have to do their shooting at night. And then we have a full perimeter fence for security. I don't know how well you can see it, but this is the designer's design of the range in its entirety, showing the range house, the parking lot, out to 300 yards, and then the smaller picture showing the 24 lanes on the top half and the 12 lanes on the bottom half. This is what a steel trap looks like. The term has been used quite a bit in describing how to build this range. This is very similar to what we will be purchasing. The only difference is instead of a dirt backdrop, we will have a cinder block wall backdrop. But all of the bullets that are fired are collected into this trap. They fall to a conveyor system, and they end up in a 55-gallon drum. The training events we've hosted so far during 2015, we've had 4 basic correctional officer classes that graduated 66 trainees. Because we don't have overnight accommodations yet, these are commuter classes. These officers come from up to 60 miles away in the morning. They attend the training, and then they drive home 60 miles. In 2016, I've met with the training director for OSDT. We currently have 18 classes scheduled for correctional officers, which will graduate 530 trainees. My understanding is Adult Corrections has over 1,000 backlog with basic correctional officers. We're going to meet half of their need in 2016. Non-DPS, again, these are other law enforcement agencies that we allow to utilize our facility. The FBI SWAT team came down last January and conducted a mechanical breach in school. In July, ATF Special Response Team conducted woodland operations where they did canine and man tracking. In October, we had Southern Pines PD, one of the local PDs there in Moore County, come and conduct active shooter for patrol officers, and they had 22 participants. We've already had, in January of this month, last week, 30 officers from local departments in North Carolina attend a 2-day advanced active shooter training class that was hosted by the local community college. They didn't have enough training space at the community college. They came to Samarkand, and we provided them with everything they needed. And in July 31, 2015, we officially opened with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. And that's my presentation on where we are with Samarkand today.
Questions from the committee? No questions? We thank you for your report.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bowles.
Yeah, I have one. Have you got the pond filled yet? And with fish in it?
No, sir, but we're working on it.
Thank you. Thank you for.
I would just like to make one comment, Mr. Jordan, President. I think a lot of us had been there before, and I think the staff went down last week, and I think they can attest that this will be a great asset, not only just for DPS, but for the state of North Carolina, being able to train our law enforcement officers, which the state does not own the facility now for our local DPS officers. And it really looks great, and I thank you for your job.
John Fairclough.
Just one question. What is the relationship between Samarkand and our North Carolina Justice Academy and the other training facilities we have? And I know they're in, I believe, under Department of Justice, but how do you work together on programs?
Follow up.
My understanding, Representative, is the Department of Justice Training Academy is located in Salemburg and Edneyville, primarily train local law enforcement officers, sheriff's deputies. They do host the SBI basic school is there. I believe the North Carolina Wildlife Law Enforcement have a basic class there. Samarkand belongs to the Department of Public Safety, where Salemburg belongs to the Department of Justice. Samarkand will primarily be dedicated to training men and women with the Department of Public Safety, Adult Corrections, Highway Patrol, SBI, ALE. We'll conduct basic training. We'll conduct in-service training and advanced training primarily for those agencies. We don't anticipate conducting local law enforcement training in general, which is what the role of Salemburg is in the Department of Justice. The Adult Corrections Training Division also has other training centers scattered around North Carolina that they utilize to conduct training for their correctional officers, probation, parole, and juvenile justice officers. We will also absorb some of those positions and some of that training at Samarkand as well.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today. And I did go to Samarkand when it was a training center for girls. And I've given the book. And if any of you will read The Wayward Girls of Samarkand, you will learn some history of Samarkand. And I'm glad they got the spelling. I sort of wanted the K, but they do have the C. But they did me a favor and did it in K today for some reason. Anyway, but thank you for being here. And I think, you know, we all need to go see how they're doing. And I'm so glad we have this facility here for our North Carolina law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Bingham. One more.
Your comments brought up one question. I took concealed carry at Salemburg. Will you offer that to the public, or is that will that still be at Salemburg exclusively?
That'll still be at Salemburg.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have expanding DNA on arrest to all felonies. It's Susan Satz from our research division. She will be followed by Amanda Thompson, forensic scientist manager, NC State Crime Lab. And she will be followed by Nels Roslin, the CFO for the Department of Justice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, you have about a three-page handout in your materials, which I'm not going to go completely through because it is mainly a list of offenses. But the 15A 266.3A was enacted back in 2010 to require that DNA be taken upon arrest for certain offenses. And then in 2005 in the budget, y'all added some additional offenses to that. The majority of those offenses are felonies. There are a couple of misdemeanors included in there. As part of that budget provision, the General Assembly directed this committee to study extending collection of DNA upon arrest to all felony offenses. So what you have here is basically a list of the offenses as they were added in 2010, as well as the additional offenses that you added in 2015, just for your reference. But I'm happy to answer any questions if there are about the current statute before we get into the rest of it.
Committee questions? Amanda Thompson. Oh, excuse me, it looks like
William, are you going to be speaking?
No, ma'am. I'm okay. Just changing.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Hi, my name is Amanda Thompson. I am the Forensic Scientist Manager of the DNA Database Section in the Crime Laboratory. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon to give you a brief snapshot of the DNA on Arrest program at the State Crime Laboratory. I'd also like, on behalf of Director Byrd, to express our appreciation for what this group did in the last legislative session in the market salary adjustment that was provided to our scientists, which has been a fantastic retention tool. As you know, it's hard to find qualified scientists that will stay in one area with the certification process and the market being so open with job opportunities in other states. So we're very appreciative. As you know, DNA technology is a very useful tool, perhaps more useful in instances where the suspect is unknown. There are two sections of the crime laboratory that process DNA evidence. The forensic biology section processes DNA evidence in criminal cases. If they are able to obtain a DNA profile from an unknown item of evidence, and if it is suitable, they enter that DNA profile into CODIS, which is the Combined DNA Index System, a federally administered DNA database. Once that unknown profile is entered into CODIS, it is routinely searched. It is searched against convicted offender and arrestee DNA profiles that are entered by the DNA database section on a weekly and monthly basis. Offender samples are received, processed, analyzed, and uploaded into CODIS by the database section. To give you a brief snapshot of the history of the arrestee law, February 1, 2011 provided for the collection of DNA upon arrest for certain felony and misdemeanor violent offenses, homicides, sexual assaults, and other violent crimes. A little over a month ago, on December 1, 2015, that law was expanded to provide for the collection of an additional 35 offenses. Since February 1, 2011, we have received 50,000 arrestee samples. We participated in a Lean Six Sigma efficiency study in 2013. That study was extremely successful for our section. We eliminated all of the backlog samples that existed in the section at that time, which was a combination of convicted offender and arrestee samples. We have no inventory at this time. We work from a month-to-month basis with the submissions from both arrestee and offender samples. So monthly, we process around 800 arrestee samples. So what happens to a sample when it enters the database section of the crime laboratory? Well, it is accessioned or received into our information management system. After it is accessioned, we look at it to determine, is the sample actually acceptable? For example, are all of the components of the DNA collection kit present? Do you have a collection card? Do you have a DNA collector? Do you have the appropriate barcodes on those items that are being submitted? If the answer is no, the sample is rejected and returned with a letter explaining the reason why to the submitting agency. If the answer is yes, then the sample moves forward in the process where we look at the actual offense for which the sample was submitted. Is the offense eligible for collection under the statute? If the offense is not eligible, we actually send it through a second review by specially trained staff who have the ability to dig a bit deeper into the person's criminal history. If after their review it's determined to be ineligible, the sample is rejected and returned to the submitting agency with an explanation. If the sample is eligible, it is batched and processed with other samples, analyzed, put through a 100% technical review, and subsequently uploaded to CODIS. Now, everything that you see in blue and yellow is completed by clerical staff in the section, with the exception of the batch process, analyze, and upload. Another efficiency that we gained in 2013 from doing the Lean Six Sigma study was making sure that we are utilizing our scientists for what they were hired for, strictly the science. So at this point, it is important to also tell you that we've had a long-standing history of outsourcing our samples
to a private laboratory, with the analysis being returned, us doing the review and the upload of that information to CODIS. We no longer outsource. As of October 2015, just a few months ago, all of our analysis is now done in-house. We validated a new chemistry kit as mandated by the federal government. We're online with it almost a year and a half prior to the time that it had to be done. We are now uploading samples in approximately 30 days or less time, whereas before when we were outsourcing, it was taking upwards of 90 days. So lots of gained efficiencies in that regard. You'll also notice in this process flow expunctions. And I have that there for a reason because it does take up a considerable amount of time, and I'll speak to that in just a moment. So the arrestee samples, offender samples, are reviewed, uploaded to CODIS, and then what happens? If you go back and you think about my first example where I talk about the other section in the crime laboratory that analyzes evidence, this is where the two sections work together. Twice a week, CODIS is searched. Any unknown DNA profiles that have been entered by the caseworking section are searched against the convicted offender and arrestee indexes within CODIS. If there is a match between an unknown DNA profile and an offender or arrestee, we call that a CODIS hit. We don't automatically report that hit out to the submitting agency. We pull the arrestee or offender sample from the repository. We have a scientist analyze that sample again for its profile. It goes through review. And then we do a confirmation. We verify that the secondary analysis profile is concordant with what was originally noted as being in CODIS for the person. We then issue a notification report to the submitting law enforcement agency so that they can take action on that CODIS hit. Just to talk a little bit about the expunction process. To date, as stated earlier, we've received 50,000 arrestee samples. 32,000 of those have been uploaded to CODIS, the discrepancy being around 18,000 samples. We don't have an inventory of samples, so those just aren't sitting there. Those were not eligible for various reasons. It could be that they were a duplicate submission, meaning we already had an offender or arrestee profile on file for the individual. Could have been an ineligible collection, and it could have been an improper collection. The majority of those were due to duplicate submissions for the same individual. Since February 1, 2011, we have received a little over 12,000 expunction requests to evaluate and expunge, if appropriate, the DNA upon arrest profile and sample for an individual. Of those 12,000, 3,200 of those were approved. So we're not looking at 32,000 arrestee profiles currently in CODIS. We're somewhere around 29,000 because when we do the expunction process, we not only remove the DNA record from CODIS, we destroy the sample. 1,800 of those requests were denials because the DNA for the individual was required to be in the database for some other reason. And the vast majority of what we have processed, upwards of 7,000, were duplicate requests or no specimen request. And a no specimen request is exactly what it states. It is a request that we have received to evaluate the expungement for an individual, and we have never received a sample for that person. We still send notification, just as we do with approvals or denials, to the subject so that they understand that an expunction request has been received on their behalf. We have evaluated it, approved, or denied that request. To give you a little bit of our successes, and I believe we also provided this in the annual report in February of 2015, this shows you the trends for CODIS hits from 2012 to present. In 2015, you'll notice that the CODIS hit number is 415, which is substantially higher than in past years. That is directly related to the number of forensic samples uploaded, which is the category beneath CODIS hits for 2015. The forensic biology section has completed a large push in the calendar year 2015 to work property crime cases. As they've entered those unknown DNA profiles from property crimes, we've seen a rise in our hits. Historically, property crimes do provide the larger number of hits when using CODIS. So you can see how the two sections work together in the use of the CODIS database. There are two additional slides prepared on cost, and Nels is coming to speak on those. Any questions for Ms. Thompson? Yes, Representative McNeil.
Yes, thank you for that presentation. Going back just a second to your 18,000 samples that weren't uploaded to CODIS, and I know you said in your presentation that a good portion of those were for duplication, but I want to touch just a second. Please explain to me, and I understand improper collection. Explain to me the difference between ineligibility and then also those that were improper collection. Could you give me your opinion on what the solution to that is? Is it better training on the local level, et cetera?
So let me touch on improper collection first. We did provide upwards of 35 training sessions around the state when the law took effect in February of 2011. We traveled throughout 2011 and into early 2012 to educate law enforcement across the state on the proper collection. We also generated a PowerPoint presentation as well as a video to show the proper mechanism for collection. And we gave, you know, in-person training on how to properly use the kit. Improper collection, I would say, generally is due to turnover within the agency where the training is not necessarily passed down. The tools are available. They're currently still on the North Carolina Justice Academy website in their training materials, and the PowerPoint and videos demonstrating the proper collection are still there. Something that we have entertained and feel that we should do, since it has been 5 years this year since the affecting the law date on February 1, 2011, we feel that we need to go back out and do a refresher on training, especially with the new updates with the additional 35 offenses this past December. I do think training is part of the issue. For ineligibility, they've just collected a sample for an offense that is not covered under the general statute. As far as duplication, you'll see where we may have an offender sample for the individual and we may receive another. Well, we already have the profile for that individual in CODIS. We don't need to analyze it again, but we do store and retain the duplicate samples at this time. For anything that was improperly collected, we do send a rejection letter to the agency with an explanation for why it is being rejected. And if we need a resubmission, because that would have been the only sample we had for the individual, we ask that they do a recollection.
Follow up.
Yeah, one quick follow up. Thank you for that. Yeah, it does sound to me like you probably need to do some retraining. And just a question off the top of my head, and this might be going too far, but would this be something that we should maybe, as a General Assembly, looking at requiring maybe a small certification for the people that are collecting it, maybe so that there is some standard there for the people that are collecting it? So it just isn't farmed out to somebody on the local level that maybe is not qualified to do it.
I certainly think that that's a great idea. I do know that there was some conversation at a point in time in incorporating it into the BLET training for officers. I'm sorry. That there was conversation about adding it to the BLET training and standards so that it is incorporated for the officers in the very beginning. But I definitely would not be in disagreement with some type of standardized class or certification.
Representative Hurley. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, and I know there have been a lot of talk about the rape kits that were behind. Have those been caught up?
To my knowledge, that work is completed by the forensic biology section, but to my knowledge, they do not have an outstanding backlog of rape cases in their inventory from the section.
Thank you.
And I think Representative Stevens has a question regarding the overall backlog at the crime lab.
I do. How are we doing on the crime lab? How many months behind are you on, say, blood analysis and toxicology and those kinds of things?
Unfortunately, I don't feel that I'm in a situation where I'm prepared to answer that question. It's something we can definitely get for you. Those numbers are definitely changing. We're doing some toxicology outsourcing, and I'm not certain of their turnaround time at this specific point.
Staff says that they will do a, that Secretary Baird or Director Baird's coming next month to do a full report. Representative Turner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess we've already talked about what's acceptable and what's not, but what percentage of DNA samples do you receive that you have to reject?
I don't have the exact numbers for you. I'll be happy to get those for you.
Do you have an estimate? Excuse me.
In the last... Just a second. In 2015, there were 14,503 offender samples received, 9,516 arrestee samples. 30% of the offender samples were duplicates and therefore were not processed. 28% of the arrestees received were duplicates and were not processed. Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. And do you have complaints generally from law enforcement officers about the returns?
At this time, we do not return duplicate submissions. We return only those samples which are rejected due to the fact that they were improperly collected or were ineligible and should not have been collected in the first place. We do include our contact information and the reason for rejection. And we actually have found that it's been a very receptive and reciprocal relationship where they're very appreciative of knowing what the issue is. And I think if anything, it has improved what we're seeing over time as far as samples that are outright rejected for being improperly collected or ineligible collection.
Follow up. And when you hit, how is that recorded? Do you record it at the lab or is it sent back and with the information so it's entered by law enforcement, or is there some duplication there? Or
so when we have a CODIS hit, we process it following the steps that I outlined earlier where we reanalyze it for its profile, carry it through the internal steps. CODIS hit confirmation process is recorded in our Forensic Advantage system. So it's released to the DA's office in the same manner as any other case report for the crime laboratory, because when you get a hit to a case, it may not be an open investigation at that time, but it's at least by doing that CODIS hit notification report, you're sending notification to the original submitting law enforcement agency that submitted that case. Hey, we've had a hit to your case. And then at that point, they can go forward with their steps to obtain the standard that they need from the individual, submit it back to the laboratory where it will be processed by our caseworking unit, and then they will issue a report. And at that point, it would be back at the DA's office to decide how to handle it.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had questions about the expungement. You listed 12,000. Expungement request. And first of all, I'm wondering, are you using expungement as in like the term is used in the court system, or are these also people who have been found not guilty, or is these actual expungement requests?
These are actually expungement requests submitted on the AOC CR 640 form for expungement of DNA on arrest. I have a group of specially trained staff that evaluate the individual's criminal history at the time that the requests are received. After their evaluation, the expunction request with an approval or denial recommended goes to our laboratory legal counsel, who then signs off on that. And then at that point, if it is an approval, we follow our FBI approved expungement process where we remove the DNA record from the CODIS database and we destroy the DNA sample. We then notify the individual via letter of their approved DNA expungement.
Follow up. And do we have any idea on a per case basis what that costs the state to do?
The actual expungement process. For an approval, which is about 27% of the total request received, it takes about 36 minutes of total staff time. A denial takes approximately 22 minutes. Don't have a figure to go along with that as far as personnel cost.
We can get that for you, sir. Come up with a reference. trust me. But we don't track that, or have not tracked that cost for the purposes of this presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you will do that and provide it to Christine Leggett so she can get it to the members. Thank you.
Other questions?
I think Senator Bingham had one.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative McNeil had one of the questions I had, was certainly interested in improper correction collections, but if a family wished to have a DNA test, could they say, for example, it was a long wait period and they wanted to pay that? Do you do individual, or would they have to send that to a private lab, or is that something that you do for individual members, period?
No, sir, we do not. We only perform DNA analysis under the statute for DNA and arrestee collection, and then for the forensic biology section only for criminal cases.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. Thank you for coming today, and we will move on with CFO Roslin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. On the last two slides, I was going to summarize the cost to analyze these samples on a per sample basis and then the overall budget for the DNA database section. This first slide you see in the middle column, the total cost for this entire operation is $2.1 million, and that's for the last fiscal year ending June 2015. During that time period, they processed 24,668 samples. The basic math is it works out to 86, 89 a sample. That was our cost before the start of this fiscal year. In the 2015 General Assembly, you all did provide funding with additional staff and resources for those 35 additional felony offenses where we're accepting these DNA samples. That specific annualized funding amount is $373,000 to test what is projected to be approximately 4,300 samples. And it has a very similar unit cost basis, if not identical. And when we look at the history of what it costs to analyze these DNA samples on a per sample basis, they have varied from $84 to $87 per sample analyzed. This last slide, I hope you can see it. I know it's pretty busy. Talks about our historical costs for the 2014 fiscal year, how we split up the funding you provided this session, and then what the combined funding is in terms of next year's budget. The vast majority of costs for this DNA database team are staff personnel focused. You see there's $1.3 million for personnel. That's for the scientists, the technicians, the professional staff that do this work. The second biggest cost driver is scientific supplies. The state crime lab does distribute these collection kits, these kind of blank kits, to all these local law enforcement agencies at no cost to the local agencies. The cost per kit there is approximately $5 a kit. After the collection samples are taken and sent back to the crime lab, the scientists and the technicians that process those kits and DNA samples, it costs approximately $22 to $23 per sample to analyze for scientific supplies. Line four shows private lab outsourcing. There was a portion of last fiscal year where we did incur charges to send these samples to a Virginia lab that helped with the analysis of the DNA profiles. Based on the previous discussion and the much shorter turnaround times, that is a process we have stopped when you look at the budget for next fiscal year. Lastly, there's a catch-all category. The crime lab DNA section has a minimum of $3 million in inventory of scientific equipment, very complex scientific devices they use to process these samples. The maintenance costs, the calibration costs are not cheap. So there's a cost related to maintaining the equipment, but also for scientist certification, professional development, postage, and other sundry costs. With respect to the funding sources and different types of funds that finance this operation, the most significant funding source you'll see on line 13 is state appropriations. For last fiscal year, about 48% of their budget was state appropriations. The second most significant funding source is we do get a federal DNA backlog grant that does help fund some of the supply costs, some of the equipment costs, and related non-salary costs. And then we also receive two dedicated court fees from the court system. There is a $2 DNA on arrest fee that was enacted in 2011, and this is a general court of justice fee that's kind of assessed against all convictions. That brings in about $434,000 a year. And then there's also a dedicated state crime lab report fee. When the crime lab performs a scientific report and works with the court system and the DAs and the individual is convicted of an offense, there is a $600 court fee that also helps finance the operation. This is a small subset. Some of those fees support other operations of the lab, but this is the subset that supports the DNA database section. With respect to the annualized funding that you all approved last session for the four additional staff and the new DNA positions, it's very similar in the composition and makeup as their old budget. The majority of that money will be spent to hire four new staff. There is also funding for scientific supplies, a little bit of equipment money, and other maintenance, postage, and related line item costs. When we look at our budget for the fiscal year that comes up next July, 2016, the combined amount is $2.5 million in expenses and $2.5 million in receipts, and that will support 23 total staff. That ends my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Bowles.
Thank you. Just curiosity on these fees. Yes, after number nine.
Yes, sir.
Other number 11, I'm sorry, the 600. What percentage is collected or did all collected?
We have budgeted, we've had a market decline in those fees in our budget. We have a budgeted level of $1.4 million. We, based on current trends, the first 6 months of this fiscal year, we'll be lucky to collect half of that. That has created a cash crunch for the lab, not just the DNA section, but the entire crime laboratory. We did an internal audit study and found that for each 100 scientific case reports sent to the court system, 17 of those actually yielded a disposition where the fee was assessed. The scientific case reports may have also exonerated innocent folks, but there were waivers, there were findings in the scientific reports or other matters well beyond our control. But right now, the basic math from looking at the historical pattern of these receipts and these collections is about 17 out of 100 equal a collection. The remaining balance has been waived or some other disposition has happened by the court system.
Follow up. Other questions? Thanks. Yes, Representative McNeil. I think it was McNeil.
Jackson.
Representative Stevens, and then Jackson.
Sorry, I was too close to his face. It just appeared it was me. I see that we have a lot of extra expense needed to do all these felonies. And, you know, expense is not the only consideration. And I think part of the consideration I have questions about is, since we've been doing this, how helpful has it been to law enforcement in, one, eliminating people from crimes, people that may have been charged and the DNA comes back, no, it's not you, it's somebody else, or how many additional criminals they've been able to match up with pending evidence? Because both of those, the innocence, the guilt, are important when we start talking about this extra expense to expand what we're doing.
I'll let Amanda tackle part of that. I think the number of CODIS hits that have been attributed to date related to the database function are results shared with the law enforcement community in terms of what actions they take with it. That's a whole other set of questions, but I'll let Amanda, she's got more details on that.
Amanda, if you'll please come forward.
Good
In regards to your question, I can tell you, to date, we've had approximately 176 arrestee hits in CODIS. The breakdown of those hits was approximately 6 homicides, 49 sexual offenses, 9 armed robberies, 2 assaults, and 101 property crimes.
Thank you.
Follow up.
I'm here. Yeah, I think it would be important to perhaps look in greater detail, because while we're saying $2 million is a lot to get more DNA, to get more DNA, get more arrestees covered under that, how much would we be saving by, you're going to get somebody in a guilty plea, you're going to do away with court appointed attorneys, you're going to do away with prosecution time, criminal, a lot of court time, a lot of court function will be saved. So before we throw the baby out with the bathwater by just saying it's too expensive, maybe we need to see, we need to study it a little more.
Response.
I'm in agreement.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Representative
Jackson. Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question for staff on following up on Chairman Wall's question on the court fees. Aren't there, in fact, two different $600 fees, one for the analysis and then an additional $600 fee if the analyst is required to make a court appearance?
B. William Childs.
Sorry, I didn't hear the whole question. Is it that are there two different $600 fees?
Correct. That's the question.
Yes, sir, there is. There's an expert witness fee, and then there's the crime lab report.
Madam Chair, if I could follow up on that.
Follow up.
Thank you. Would it be possible to get this chart broken up with the two fees? I assume you've combined them in this line. Are you telling me one of them is not on here?
Yes, we can get you additional information. The expert witness fees, Mr. Jackson, are minimal in comparison to the report fees. I think for last year, we brought in about $50,000 in total fee collections related to those fees. And we brought in about $800,000 with the other ones. And that's last fiscal year. But we can get additional information on the breakout of that.
Follow up.
If I could just make a comment, it has long been my belief that if the General Assembly would take action and mandate that these two fees not be waived in some way, that we would address both a funding issue and our Melendez-Diaz decision issue, because it would end the playing of games of having defendants plead guilty once the analyst is driven to Asheville to testify and actually shows up in the courtroom. And if those fees were not able to be waived in some way, I think you'd see that you would have your analyst in the labs a lot more than they were traveling to court.
I think William Childs has a response to your first question.
Representative Jackson, this is William Childs. There are 6 different lab fees and expert witness fees that are set at $600.
So your point is noted, and that is something that we will certainly take a look at.
Madam Chair, back here to your left. Susan Seitz.
Excuse me. Knew the voice, couldn't identify the location.
Sorry.
Susan Seitz.
Just sort of a clarification to the whole discussion of potentially adding all felonies, something that I probably should have gone into a little bit more detail. The study directive to this committee asked this committee to tell the General Assembly how to actually implement it to collect DNA from all felons upon arrest. I think that the directive is broad enough that the committee could say to the General Assembly, but we don't think you should do it if that's what you want to say, or because it's too expensive or whatever. But it actually directs this committee to recommend a timeline, to come up with what it would cost, and basically set up a plan for how that could be done, whether or not if the General Assembly chooses to do it. So just to keep that in mind.
Do you want to address that, Nels?
Yes, Madam Chairman, my read of the statute is the commission's tasked with a study. We are happy to help you with whatever information you need to accomplish the study.
Thank you. Any other questions for the committee? Thank you both for coming. Hold on 1 second. Do you have any calculations today regarding the cost on the expansion to all felonies, or do you have those figures with you, or would you want staff to do that?
In rough numbers, when we looked at various fiscal notes and worked with Ms. Leggett and others, it would be at anywhere from a 250 to 300% increase in their volume of incoming cases. It would be a significant increase in staff, the scientific supplies, these other costs we've highlighted here. First and foremost, we got to figure out a space plan. We got to find somewhere where additional staff could go. I can share with you, we have made improvements in the Raleigh lab. The Raleigh Crime Lab is a 130,000 square foot facility built in 1996. There are big component sections of the lab where it's 65% office space and 35% lab space. There's opportunity to squish more scientists in there, but I have an accounting and finance background. This is where we need architects and engineers. You all are helping us build a Western lab. Building new construction and crime labs to be safe, secure, and to deal with their intensive internal systems, that's costing us $460 a square foot. It's not a renovating labs, building new labs is expensive, but we can engage the appropriate professionals and address any questions to help you all come up with a firm number. I'm sorry, I don't have an exact number on space, but that's the first kind of domino that would have to fall as a space plan, construction for a year or two, and then adding the appropriate staff to implement the new felonies or whatever the policy direction of this body is.
Thank you. And I will recognize Christine Leggett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did some calculations on this issue last year, and based on an estimated number of an additional sample number of 85,000 new samples, the recurring costs once the program was fully in place would be $8.4 million a year, and that does not include capital cost. Now, when we did these calculations, that included outsourcing, and so they have since changed their process. I'm not entirely sure how that would change the estimate, but it is still it was $8.5 million, not including capital, when we did it last year.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you both. Thank you very much. Other comments from the committee? Yes, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment from my thank you, folks, for your presentation. I know it's alarming when we start talking about $8 million and the high sums of money that we have to pay for cases being going through the scientific process. But if you think, when we talk in terms of six homicides or whatever that figure was, if that homicide was in your family, how much would it be worth to find that wrongdoer? Or if that rape kit was analyzed and helped to find the person that raped your daughter, you can't put a cost on that. And we owe it to the citizens of this state, if there's a way to put these wrongdoers, and we're talking about felons, serious felons, if there's a way to put them in prison, then we ought not to step back and say we can't do it because of a dollar. We need to find a way to make it happen.
Thank you. And Representative McNeil.
And I agree with what Representative Faircloth said, but I also see a lot of duplicity in what we're doing now. And part of the solution has to be we need to stop sending 18,000 samples to the lab that are duplicates or improperly collected or ineligible. So that's 18,000 less that they have to deal with. So, you know, maybe if we can do something on that, to kind of clean up that mess. I mean, because 18,000 samples of 50,000 samples, that's a third of the samples. So I think that's got to be part of the solution.
Thank you. Other comments? I'm going to go over the meeting dates for our upcoming meetings. We, of course, are assigned the second Thursday of the month, 1 p.m., so our next meeting will be February the 11th, March 10th, April 14th. Now, your subcommittee chairs will notify you of subcommittee meetings. We'll try to coordinate those with the regular meetings, but, you know, we'll do the best that we can. And with that said, and no further comment or discussion, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.